Hey everyone, you're listening to Liam Unfiltered, episode 107, which is executive produced by Says the Cube. I'm Liam, and you're joining me for a solo podcast today, just me. I'm recording this on about midnight on my birthday. I've been very busy today. It's not been my birthday today. My birthday is on the 24th, but in the day before, I've been very busy, so that's why I'm recording this so late at night. I'm going to be ruminating on a number of things and just generally having a bit of a ramble. So if you're down for that, if that's something you're interested in, listening to me sort of rant and rave about various things that have been going on recently, then this is the podcast for you. I don't really have much of a plan, to be honest. I'm just going to go off, ramble about some of the things I've been playing, some recent news, and maybe I'll have a look at what's going on in the news at the minute while I talk to you guys. I'm going to bring up some Nintendo websites and see. But yeah, there hasn't really been a whole lot happening. I did see that Nintendo is publicly ruminating, discussing about how they are going to be doing more Nintendo films, which is great. I love that idea. I imagine Zelda probably be one of the next ones. Donkey Kong were rumors of a spin-off to that. So, I mean, I hope that they continue and we continue to get more faithful video game adaptations because from what I remember, the Mario Brothers movies become like the highest grossing animated feature of all time now, which is crazy. I mean, I expected it to do well, but that is pretty unprecedented. Really crazy to see not only a video game adaptation do that well, but an animated film in general, right? It's great to see animated films, more animated films, just in general, attaining success. Like, there's been some really good ones this year. Puss in Boots, Suzume just came out. So that I thought was great. The new Spider-Verse movie is coming out. And yeah, it's great to see all these different styles of animation. Not all of them 3D, you know, traditional CGI 3D, like how the Mario Brothers movie looks. But, you know, they're doing all interesting things in their own respective ways. And yeah, if this gets us more faithful video game adaptations, I would love to see what they do with Zelda. Zelda's a big, like, question mark, in my opinion, because Link is really, like, a non-character. He's more kind of like a self-insert for the player, hence his name, Link, right? So I really don't know what you do there. Like, do you make side characters like Navi play a bigger role and that type of thing? Zelda, I'd be really interested to see what they would do. But I dread what that might entail. I think a Zelda anime series or movie could be really good if handled correctly. But I would not hand it to a company like, say, Illumination, you know, who are going to fill it with, you know, broad mainstream comedy tropes and that type of thing. I mean, I like the Mario movie, but those are undeniably present, a lot of that stuff. There's a lot of, I would say, Secret Life of Pets inspiration that I didn't particularly care for. I mean, I enjoyed the film, but yeah. So I'm interested to see what they do with that. I would like to see some proper Nintendo anime series or movies, kind of similar to what they did with Kid Icarus. When Kid Icarus Uprising came out, they did some animated shorts. Why not expand those? And obviously we got that fantastic 2D animated, it was like an anime cutscene or like a trailer that they did for the introduction, I think, of Palutena in Smash Bros., which was fantastic. I'd love to see them do more of that, but expand it, you know? I always thought that like Star Fox could make a really cool series. And that was another thing they did, a kind of a CGI trailer for. I can't remember what it was called, but for Star Fox Zero, they did some sort of animated featurette, which gave you a little glimpse into the lives of the Star Fox crew. And honestly, I always thought like this would be perfect as its own show, as its own series. But Nintendo just seems to do these kind of one-off experiments with Pikmin, with Kid Icarus, with Star Fox, and then they don't really go beyond that, at least so far. But supposedly Nintendo has this whole animated initiative that they are pushing and expanding upon, and hopefully this takes us to some more interesting places. I know a lot of people talked about wanting Metroid, and I think you could do something really interesting, like a kind of a horror sci-fi thing, because obviously the original Metroid takes so much inspiration from Alien. It would be cool to see something done there, but obviously Nintendo is not going to let them do anything too violent. But still, I think you could play upon the horror tropes and that type of thing to create something interesting there. Yeah, you could. That's like another Nintendo series where you could do a really cool anime feature with, I think. But the one I would hope to see is, I'd love to see a Star Fox series and some sort of Zelda movie or show. But it seems like they're probably going to go for another like blockbuster movie. The DK spin-off, that's been rumored for a while. And really, what else could you do? Obviously, you're going to do more Mario. But yeah, I don't know. Let me know your thoughts on that whole subject. I guess, you know, the big thing I've been playing is Advance Wars. And I'm going to talk about that. But I did want to talk, honestly, about Twitter. Because Twitter, at the moment, it kind of feels like it is the beginning of the end for that whole place. And I imagine a lot of you know me through there, have come across my content through there, or I don't know, you found this podcast through there, you know, whatever the case may be. And I've met a lot of great people through Twitter. I've said, you know, I know it's not fashionable to say this, but because everyone calls it like a hell site and everything, and certainly it has its problems. But over the years, I've really enjoyed my time on Twitter. I've made so many friends and gotten to know so many interesting people. You know, I've made friendships through Twitter that I imagine will last the rest of my life. You know, I've made lifelong friends through there, and that's definitely, you know, a big plus. But the site, in terms of usability, feels like it is in a death spiral at the minute. They introduced Twitter Blue, of course, the paid subscription where you get the blue tick. They've gotten rid of the original verification system. And now, obviously, you've got people impersonating other people, which is a big problem. But the wider problem that I see as just an average user now is that the replies on every tweet are the Twitter Blue users pushed to the top. And I honestly did not think like it was going to be that much of a problem. I thought, oh yeah, sure, Twitter Blue users are going to get pushed to the top. Who really cares? Who really cares about that? But I think maybe I underestimated how much I like to look at the top of the replies, because sometimes you get some interesting insights from other people. You get some funny replies, some funny jokes, some funny memes. But it just so happens that the quality of banter, of patter, of insight, of comedy, of anything, is so low among Twitter Blue users. I hate to generalize, not really. I will generalize, I don't really care. But it feels to me like these are just like the dumbest fucking people in the whole goddamn world. And they are pushed, like the top of every reply section on any big tweet now is exclusively composed of the dumbest motherfuckers you've ever goddamn come across. None of them are funny. None of them have anything interesting to say. They are just basically saying like, haha, interesting. You know, they just have nothing going on. Nothing at all. And Twitter is an interesting, I think, experiment when you go against traditional media theory. In media theory, you have this thing, it's called the two-step flow of communication. And this is going to sound hella pretentious, but this is basically a model of audience effects from the 1960s, which basically suggests like there are two types of participants in media. There are opinion leaders and there are the masses. There are the people who receive the opinions. And Twitter Blue, to me, feels like an interesting experiment where you depower all of the opinion leaders in our society and you replace them with the masses who aspire to be those people. And what you end up with is this, is the replies to every tweet being composed of absolutely nothing. They have nothing interesting to say because these are not opinion leaders. And what I mean is, like, the celebrities, the writers, the artists, the people who people look up to and listen to in our society. And some people are going to think I'm fucking pretentious as hell for saying this, whatever. And I'm not including myself in here, whatever. But I mean, you know, the big writers, the celebrities, the entrepreneurs. You can debate whether it's right or wrong to look up to those people. But the people who are opinion leaders in our society, this new version of Twitter has depowered them. So they've taken away the blue ticks, taken away how they are prioritized in terms of visibility, and we've replaced them with the people who aspire to be those people. And what you end up with is what we've got here is absolute drivel. It's just a site overrun with crypto spammers and just the lowliest fucking scumbags who are just the most boring bootlicking idiots who, once again, they've got nothing to say, nothing constructive to add to the conversation, because these people are not opinion leaders. They do not have their own ideas. And of course, you know, this is a very kind of old theory of media that I'm citing. And yes, it does sound a bit pretentious to invoke it, but I think it does have some applicability here, because you get to see what happens when the prominent, previously prominent opinion leaders in our society are replaced with people who for years have aspired to be those people, but we're not. And the reason for that is because they don't have anything interesting to say, or they don't know how to reach that level of an audience. They're not clever enough to cultivate an audience of their own in order to espouse their views to them. And so that's kind of how I feel about it, is that it has turned the website on its head. And so everything I fucking see now, for the most part, when I leave the feed on my Twitter where I look at the people I'm following, is just people who, it seems like their brains are decomposing, dematerializing before my eyes, you know? And so it is both funny and sad and pathetic, seeing all the ways in which these people are inventing new forms of aggrievement before my eyes, whining about getting bullied for having a blue tick and whatever. Hey, welcome to my world. That's how it used to be. But I never complained about that, you know what I mean? It has been very funny seeing these people coping, whining, because people don't want to pay $8 for a blue tick. I've constantly seen the same thing espoused again and again. What, you don't have $8? And, you know, my answer to that is, I do have $8. I have $8 that you do not, because you've spent it on Twitter. And I can spend that on something else that I might want to. And, seeing all the leaps in logic, all the ways in which people are trying to justify it to themselves, having this new thing, when it is blatantly obvious that they wanted to pay for a status symbol. And, you know, I'm someone who previously had the old blue tick or whatever, and the reason I got it was not a status symbol or anything like that, genuinely. It was just because people were impersonating me. people were pretending to be me. I had some low effort trolls who would use my face and go around and say really horrible transphobic and sort of Nazi-ish things. And so it was a way to curb that. But now it basically means nothing. It is basically putting a sign on your head which says that you're an idiot, that you're a rube, you're a mark who will pay $8 to one of the dumbest people in the world, a billionaire bastard who doesn't have a goddamn clue. And you know, just to illustrate that, you know, I mean, I don't like Elon Musk. I think I've made that very clear by this point. I don't think he has a goddamn clue what he's doing with this website. And that's why every time he introduces a feature, he backtracks on it and that type of thing. You know, I was reading something earlier on Twitter that I think for me illustrated the disparity between what his fans think of him versus reality so well. And it is these two tweets that I saw within about a few hours of each other. And I've saved them because I wanted to read them to you because I think it's kind of funny. This tweet comes from an Elon enthusiast called Pooja, at Pooja Media on Twitter. And this is, I don't know who the hell this is. Some sort of YouTube guy who looks up to Elon Musk. And this is what he says. So this is from April 20th, which was the day when they got rid of the legacy blue ticks and they replaced everything with the new version of Twitter with, you know, new prioritization for the paid Twitter blue users. And so Pooja says, Elon removed over 400k legacy verification. So imagine 400,000 out of them pay for Twitter blue at $8. 400,000 times $8 equals 3,200,000 per month. And then he says underneath that, businessman of life, with like a little emoji saying like rock on, you know, that sort of fist gesture. So that's what the Elon fans think is going to happen. Now, meanwhile, in reality, we have a tweet from Ben Collins, who is a senior reporter for NBC News, which I sometimes see on my timeline. Not someone I follow, but someone who seems to have their head screwed on. And this is what he says. Curious, and by the way, this is 2 days after the great blue tick erasure day happened on the 20th of April. This is what Ben says on the 22nd of April. Curious how many people actually signed up for Twitter Blue yesterday and today? Well, I've got the numbers and I'll be telling them. Here's a hint. There was a net plus 28 between signups and cancellations. Not 2,828. And then he goes on to say in the next tweet, of the 420,000 legacy blue ticks, about 320 signed up for Twitter Blue, and around 290 got rid of Twitter Blue as of about noon today. So that guy in the previous tweet, Pooja, is talking about 38 million worth of revenue per year from verified legacy users. That's what he thought was going to happen. But the reality is several hundred dollars. I just think that's amazing. That's maybe, I've not done the maths on that. I don't know, maybe like $500 at most that they made as a net profit from this whole exercise that has turned the website on its head. From that group of users, they got plus 28 users. This is amazing to me. This is meant to be the thing that saves the website, that turns it around into profit. They've had all these advertisers flee for the hills And this is the thing that's meant to turn around the website. This website is fucked. I'm sorry. I'm calling it right now. We are in the end days of Twitter, if that is true. I mean, my God. Twitter Blue, evidently a gigantic failure. Nothing interesting about it at all. Why? I cannot fathom why anyone would fucking pay for this. Is editing tweets really that important? Is posting longer tweets really that important to some people? If anyone posts a long tweet on Twitter, my eyes just glaze over. Maybe it's because I have ADHD. I don't give a fuck. If somebody sends me like a fucking diatribe on Twitter, I'm not reading it, man. I come to Twitter precisely because of that brevity. I like to see what people can say with that amount of characters. And the more you can post on Twitter, I think that lessens and lessens the appeal. And if anyone ever sends me a massive reply, or if I see a massive diatribe from someone about some inconsequential bullshit, which it mostly is, I'm not going to read it. And I think that's the case for a lot of people. So yeah, I just don't see the appeal of Twitter Blue. When I had my blue tick, they were sending me all these notifications on Twitter. Oh, you're going to lose your blue tick. Give us $8 and we'll let you keep it. Like, every time I logged in, there was some sort of threat like that. And I don't care. Why? It means nothing now. You know, maybe, let's say in a hypothetical other universe where Twitter was run by more savvy businessmen. Maybe if they were like, all right, it's like a dollar a month and you get all of these privileges and the old verification system is in place. Maybe I would consider paying that, you know, if the verification actually meant something, if it verified that I am me. But now it doesn't verify your identity at all. All it verifies is your willingness to hand over $8 for effectively nothing. And it just screams, anyone who has this, it is the mark of someone who cares way too much about clout, who is way too invested in social media clout. I'm sorry, that's how I feel about it. But yeah, I just felt like I would have a big rant about that because It does make me sad on some level, seeing Twitter go to absolute shit. But it's funny all the same, you know, seeing the extent of its failure, seeing how much of a gigantic flop Twitter Blue has been, and seeing all of the people whining about getting made fun of because of their stupid little blue tick that they paid for. I mean, the whole thing is a gigantic mess. I saw someone today directly compare the experience of getting made fun of for having a Twitter badge to getting mocked for being black, which is an interesting take. It's surprising to me that take didn't come sooner, because that's what happens when you concentrate the dumbest people on the planet to the highest part of exposure on the website, is that you expose the dumbest, worst opinions possible to as many people as possible. So that is very, very funny, I suppose. You know, the site is going to hell. It is sad on some level, but also at the same time, you can't help but laugh, right? So why not? All right, so moving on from that whole bullshit, I did want to talk about Advance Wars because finally, Advance Wars Reboot Camp 1 and 2, the remake, I guess, of the Game Boy Advance strategy games has finally launched on the Switch. A long, long time coming, delayed because of the conflict in Ukraine. And yeah, I mean, it's finally here. I've been playing through it a bit. And I initially expected, honestly, that I would go straight to Advance Wars 2 because I'd never played it before. But honestly, it's been probably about 7 years since I've played Advance Wars. I first played Advance Wars one, I think on the Game Boy Advance, but I never owned it. And then I finally played through it for the first time, like fully all the way to the end on the Wii U. Because when the Wii U had its eShop, you could download Advance Wars from it. And that's one of the things I downloaded. And I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it back on the Game Boy Advance. But it is a super, I think, overlooked strategy game. I love strategy games, but it surprised me the strategic depth, I think, of these games, because they look so simple. And it's kind of, I think, like playing a game of chess or something like that. It's not, I would say, as complex as something like Fire Emblem, and you don't have leveling up in the same way that those games have, at least not in the original Advance Wars. It is more like each map, they give you a series of resources and a series of units, and it is your job to figure out how to conquer the opponent within those constraints. Whereas in Fire Emblem, it is more like, you know, you have a lot of customization, you are building up the same units for every battle, and figuring out how to tweak them to get the upper hand of the opponent, and there's a lot of RPG elements involved. But Advance Wars is more of just a straight battle simulator type situation. And they are, I think, two equally valid flavors of Nintendo strategy gameplay. And I enjoy both of them. But I think Advance Wars is long overdue a comeback. I personally would have liked to have seen Intelligent Systems do a modernized spin on it. But I am enjoying this reboot, this remake, I suppose. There's a lot to get into, I guess, on the specifics of this remake. Obviously, it is the original two put together, reimagined in quite a different art style. The game utilizes a mixture of 2D hand-drawn art and animations by WayForward, the primary developer. And it is a mixture of that 2D hand-drawn art and 3D models. And I think the results are largely, in my opinion, good, but certainly not perfect. In my opinion, the 2D hand-drawn art, which is used for the opening, it is used for characters during dialogue, and the little cutscenes you have there, and in certain menus, I think that stuff looks fantastic. I love the way the characters look. It is basically, what they've done is, they've taken how the characters looked in the promotional art, and in some of these sprite-based cutscenes, but they've reimagined them, updated them, added some subtle modernization with a style that looks like how the characters look in, say, Shantae. And I think on that front, it looks great. I really, really dig what they've done here. It almost has a kind of a cel-shaded 3D-ness to it. It's quite hard to describe what I mean there. But yes, I think the characters themselves, the way they're animated is so expressive and full of character and fun to look at. I love that. On the other hand, I do think that the 3D models, especially for the soldiers, don't look that great. They're not bad by any stretch of the imagination. They're clearly meant to be, I would say, 3D models very closely based upon the original sprites. But to me, the original sprites had more character. They had more charm. They looked better. The actual battles between the units, which play out when you do a move, I think it looked better in the original game, to be honest. And I really, really wish that they had committed to the 2D hand-drawn art, which is used elsewhere in the game, and found a way to implement that in the strategy gameplay, when you are seeing attacks performed during gameplay. because I think that is when the game looks its worst. When you were actually maneuvering units about on the boards, when you were seeing attacks take place, it looks very hit or miss in my opinion. I don't particularly think that the original style translates well to 3D. I think it looked better in 2D as sprites, and I wish they'd either stuck with sprites, which gave Advance Wars a very unique look, or they had gone with they committed to the 2D hand-drawn art, and we got something that would look more, in my imagination, more like Streets of Rage, when you see how the gameplay of that looks. And another thing that I'm not a really big fan of is the sandbox border around the perimeter of the map, because this is not a thing in the original game, but in this remake, during each battle, there is a wooden border around the perimeter of each map, which makes it look like you are playing as you were enacting a war inside a toy box or something like that, or a sandbox, like a child's play area thing. And I really don't understand that artistic choice to add that. In my opinion, it doesn't really add anything good to the mix. I mean, narratively, Advance Wars has its own world and lore and story and characters and everything. So these aren't toys. There is a world going on here with its own seemingly political system. It has its own nations and everything, you know, in the same way that Fire Emblem does. But then when you're in battles, you have these wooden borders around the battles that makes them look like toys. And, you know, some people are fine with that. And ultimately, does it bother me that much? Not really. But it doesn't really fit for me. I don't like this little artistic flourish. And it's going to be a small thing for some people. It's going to be a big deal for others. I would encourage people to see how they actually feel when they play it. Because as much as I don't like that idea, and as much as I don't think that the 3D models are as good as they could have been, maybe, I have to admit that all of these little niggles that I feel just melt away when I'm playing it. At its core, these are very faithful remakes of the original games with the same maps and layouts and the same amazing strategy gameplay. It is really, really good. Really, really good fun. And I thought to myself, as I was saying before, that I would just skip right to Advance Wars 2. But to remind myself of the gameplay, I went in and I chose Advance Wars 1. And interestingly, it does give you like a choice. It says to you, like, have you played Advance Wars before? Have you not? Are you a beginner? And the game will address you differently based upon which option you choose. And I chose, you know, I've played Advance Wars before, and the game spoke to me like I'm an old pal settling in at a bar with some pals that I'm catching up with, and I like that. It was like, hey, welcome back to the fight, that type of thing. So I thought that was cool. But yeah, once I got into Advance Wars 1 again, I didn't want to stop playing it. I was already interested in the story. I know where it goes. But I can't stop playing it. As soon as I started, you know, got into it again, got past the tutorial, I was just enjoying the hell out of this. And I think this will be the same for anyone who has any remote appreciation of strategy games. I think these are some of the best strategy games Nintendo has ever made. Maybe of all time, I'm not sure. And yeah, I do have some niggles with the presentation, but, and I think this will be the same for a lot of people, once you are actually in the flow of the game, you care less and less about those little niggles, and you just enjoy having an HD version of Advance Wars with some nice little tweaks of modernization on modern platforms. And I am just enjoying the hell out of these games. I haven't gotten to Advance Wars 2 yet, but I will soon. And I would just encourage everyone to pick this up. If you are a Nintendo fan, if you've never experienced Advance Wars before, set aside your trepidations and just pick this up, because I think everyone will get into this. Yeah, I mean, there are some presentational things that I as I've said, some niggles that I have. But when I'm playing it, those melt away. I'm no longer thinking about them at all. I'm just enjoying how well put together this is, how good it feels. And, you know, for the most part, I do think it looks good. I mean, yeah, it could look better, but I still think everyone should support this. If this means we get more Advance Wars, I mean, I pray that there are Nintendo fans giving this a shot. It's a shame that it hasn't been as marketed as I think it needed to be successful. But yeah, at the very least, I do hope that a new audience, a new generation of Nintendo fans, of people who've gotten into stuff like Fire Emblem, get to experience this, because I think it's every bit as good as the modern Fire Emblem games, in my opinion. They're very different, they are more simple in a lot of ways, but they are every bit as satisfying and fun to play. And, I mean, yeah, I can't say enough good things about them. At their core, these are the original two Advance Wars games, which are fantastic. I mean, yes, I've not played the second one, but I hear it's more of the same, and that's fine with me. I'm actually interested to see in which ways the second one differs, because I'm not there yet. But I mean, I've played Advance Wars, I think the first one twice before this now, and so this is my third time playing through it. And again, I'm just enjoying the hell out of it. It is a fantastic game, and I think everyone should pick this up. Even if you've played this before, getting into these is so much fun. And it did not take any time at all for me to be absolutely absorbed in it once again, enjoying the hell out of it. So this gets a hearty recommendation from me. I think people should support it on principle, because this franchise, the series, deserves to come back in a big way. And I hope that in the future we do see a brand new sequel. Because, yeah, I kind of feel like with the circumstances around its release, and by the way, it is very easy to see why it was delayed, because it is about an invasion from a foreign nation, which is very heavily coded to be, you know, basically inspired by the USSR. I mean, their bases in each map look like the Kremlin. So there you go. And also, they are very clearly meant to be Russian soldiers invading another land. So you can see why it might not have been seen as appropriate to release it when it was originally planned to come out. So I get that. And that's a shame. I mean, obviously, there are far worse things that have come of the conflict in Ukraine than this whole thing. But, you know, I'm just saying one knock-on effect is that it has kind of bumped this game into obscurity. It hasn't gotten as much marketing as I think it should have. And I think a lot of people are going to forget about it because, you know, Tears of the Kingdom is pretty close on the horizon now. We can just about see it. And, yeah, but I still hope that people give this game a chance. Maybe later in the year, if you don't want to pick it up now, definitely give it a try if you've never played these games. Or if you just want to experience them again, I think it's totally worth it. The other thing, which I've been playing recently, is the Burning Shores expansion to Horizon Forbidden West. And I finished it tonight, and I thought I'd give my thoughts on that as well. This is something set after the ending of the original campaign. And I would say overall, I enjoyed parts of it, but I do think it highlights a number of big problems that I think all of these Horizon games have. And, you know, I really like the world of Horizon. I think the lore of Horizon is really interesting. But there are some shortcomings to this DLC and to Forbidden West in general, I would say. But yeah, let me talk specifically with Burning Shores. One big problem I had here is that this is a campaign, a new story, where Aloy is off in this new environment, which is based around like a post-apocalyptic Los Angeles. And so you have to have played the original story to completion in order to access it. And when you get to this new location, there are lots of things to do, obviously. And as with the other Horizon campaigns, there are puzzles to be done. Environmental puzzles, pushing crates, destroying things, moving obstacles, you know, video game puzzles. And yet, even though I've completed this frickin' game, the game is still giving me so many hints during the puzzle sections, to the point at which it actively ruins my enjoyment of these puzzles. And how it does that is that Aloy, the main character, just never stops talking. And I like Aloy. Aloy is a great character, in my opinion. She is one of the best video game protagonists to come out in recent years. And I enjoy Aloy as a character, but she just talks way too much during regular gameplay. She's constantly narrating every little thing that is happening, even if you've done it a million times before. Like, you'll go up to a new camp where you can save, a new save point, and she'll talk about the new save point. But I've seen like a million of these, you know what I mean? Or you'll see a thing you can grapple up to, and you've seen many, many of these throughout the whole game, and she'll mention it. Why don't I grapple up there? I remember at one point, I'm in this area of the map, a kind of an underground dungeon, and there was this really quite elaborate, interesting puzzle which involved moving crates onto pressure points and working an elevator up and down so I could move the crates and place it in various places so I could reach higher levels. And it was actually a very cleverly designed puzzle. But the experience, the enjoyment of playing through that was completely undermined by the fact that Aloy just tells you the solution to the puzzle within about 20 seconds of you being able to do it. And so I really easily could have done the puzzle. I really easily could have figured out what to do. But it really does feel like in modern Sony games, Sony possesses so little faith in the audience to figure out puzzles. And this became a problem in God of War Ragnarok as well. There's a lot of, I think like your partner character, usually Atreus, telling you, oh, hey, this is what you need to do. You need to go off and do this. I remembered I complained about this, I think on Twitter, and somebody accused me of being ableist, which is an interesting thing to say to a disabled man. But nevertheless, I just wish that I could tone this down. I have no problem necessarily with the character, you know, after 20 minutes coming out and giving you a little hint saying, hey, why don't you try this? But it happens immediately in these games, to the point at which I really wish I would have enjoyed figuring out the solution myself. And I was really on the verge of doing it when Aloy told me in this specific situation I'm thinking of, and it was deflating. It was like, you know, arriving at that realization myself would have been really fun. It would have been satisfying. Like, this is cleverly designed, a really well-made puzzle that is enjoyable to solve, but they've robbed me of that enjoyment. They've basically robbed me of a bit of content of the game by spoiling it for me. And it's mandatory. You cannot turn this off in the game. There's no toggle for it. You can't turn it off altogether. You can't toggle the amount at which it happens. Aloy just never stops talking. Even if you've done something many, many times in the past. Even if you've finished the game in which these mechanics... Let me go back a second. It is the sequel to the game that introduced these mechanics. So I've already played through Horizon Zero Dawn. I've played through most of the Frozen Wilds DLC. I've finished Horizon Forbidden West. And now I'm on to like the fucking fourth campaign that you've developed. And you're still trying to tell me basic mechanics about moving crates and opening doors and that I need to find a key to open the door, or I need to find a digit to type into the door to open it. I know you don't need to freaking remind me every goddamn minute. I mean, it really does feel like it is insulting my intelligence. And yeah, that's why I say it feels like these games are just focus tested to hell. And I think Sony maybe sees people getting stuck on a puzzle for like a few minutes or something, and they're like, well, we'll have none of that. We need non-stop forward momentum. These games have got to be like roller coaster rides. And so I think, you know, either have puzzles and let people fucking solve them and have faith in the player to do that, or don't include puzzles. Make a game about something else. Make it more action focused if that's what you want to do. And yeah, that's what I strongly suspect has happened here, is like they focus tested these things and some people got stuck and they weren't having any of that. And that's such a shame, because puzzles take up a decent amount of these games, but they are completely undermined by the protagonist who won't stop talking. And that's such a shame, because I really want to like Aloy, and I do like Aloy, but... And this goes, I suppose, for other Sony protagonists and other Sony main characters as well. Like, Sony, you gotta let them just shut up. Let me fucking solve these things. Or at the very least, give me an option to toggle this on or off. Because this is ridiculous. It is getting more and more of a problem as time goes on. People are not that stupid. Well, some people are. Some people who pay for Twitter Blue are. But I think unless you pay for Twitter Blue... You do not need Aloy to tell you constantly, like, oh, here's how you open a door, here's how you move a crate. Like, I know, I can figure it out, thanks. But other than that, I have been enjoying it. You know, Horizon is always very fun to spend some time in, discovering the new creatures. The creature designs in these games are always fantastic, seeing which mechanical creature you're going to be up against next. But I have to say, in the case of Burning Shores, in the case of this DLC... you're in a new map, which is apparently about a third the size of the original map, which was already very big. But I have to say that this map is pretty barren. You know, it's very large, but there are big parts of it where there is next to nothing to collect. Something I appreciate about the main game and about games like this and Breath of the Wild is that your eye is constantly drawn to something interesting on the horizon. And that's not the case here. There are tons of abandoned buildings and ruins and that type of thing. But you're very limited by what you can actually interact with. There are many, many, you know, crumbling skyscrapers that you can fly over and that type of thing. And very few of them you can actually interact with. They're just sort of decoration, which is disappointing. One thing that this game touted as a big feature is that you have like this flying mount now, which is introduced late in Horizon Forbidden West in the original game, which was fantastic because it added an element of verticality. It made exploring the world much quicker and that type of thing. So it was good in the original game, but here where they're trying to emphasize it more, you realize how limited the mounts are in these games. The mounts should be like the coolest part of the game, in my opinion. You know, flying around, exploring these massive worlds on the back of a big mechanical bird. It's awesome, and there is a novelty to it. But really, you can't really do anything with the water wing. You're very limited. I mean, there was one set piece that involved the water wing, which I thought was quite cool, where I had to fly into some clouds and figure out what was causing this storm to occur on this specific island. And that was really cool. I thought that was well done. But really, you're very limited with what you can do with the water wing. The water wing has no offensive capabilities. You cannot shoot your bow and arrow, or use any weapon for that matter, on the back of a mount. Or on the back of the water wing, the big bird. Which sucks. because anytime you have to fight an enemy or whatever, you have to get off it anyway. And so the game just goes back to being how it was before. And the Water Wing cannot really fight on your behalf. There's no way to get it to attack the enemies as you're... Like, how cool would that be if you get off the mount and it attacks the enemies for you? The Water Wing, or the Sun Wing, or whatever the original one was called, they don't do that. They just sort of hover around and get shot by the enemy if you're near enemies. And, like, that sucks. They've put such a big emphasis on the mounts, on the Water Wings in the marketing. They're fun, I guess, to explore, and they're cool creatures, don't get me wrong, but they're just not that much fun. You can't really do anything with them. You can pick up some items, but in general, they really don't do a whole lot. Sometimes they can be used to break open doors, I think, in the environment sometimes, but they can't be used in combats, and they aren't really used to their full potential in exploration either. One big thing that they put forward as a, you know, big new feature is that the Water Wing can go underwater. So you can go and swim under the water with the Water Wing. But in the Burning Shores map, there's like nothing to do in the water. So what is the point even in having that? It just seems to me like this was a pretty easy thing for them to slap on. But it would have been cool if you actually got to do something with the Water Wing underwater. But you don't get to. It can't fight underwater. There's nothing to collect under the water. It's used in one set piece to avoid enemy fire from a cannon which is above the water. You have to go underwater. And that's about it. So I was disappointed by that. The big signature boss fight of this DLC, I have to say, was very cool, without spoiling it. There is a gigantic boss battle that occurs towards the end of the DLC. And that was the first time, I think, in this game where I felt like it was really leveraging the power of the PS5 to deliver something on a spectacle front. And yeah, I think on a spectacle front, at least, it delivered. It was a little bit cumbersome, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really cool. The scale of it is one of the biggest boss fights that I've seen on the PS5 so far. So that was really cool. And the story I enjoyed for the most part. I thought, you know, I'll always enjoy the stories in these games. And getting to see Lance Reddick as Silence one more time, which, you know, does have a small role in this DLC. Wow, what a punch in the gut that was. That was unexpected. But so yeah, I think I would recommend this to people who like Horizon. But I don't know if it's like must-play material, you know? It kind of gives you a hint at what's to come, but it really doesn't live up, I think, to the potential of a lot of its ideas, such as the Water Wing. You don't really get to do anything with it. You get to fly around, and that's about it. They need to fix the whole thing with Aloy talking during puzzles. I do think melee combat could be improved a lot in these games. There were some interesting new things that they added, which I don't want to spoil. But I think, yeah, in general, this is one more just for the Horizon fans to tide us over for the inevitable final game or whatever is coming next, you know. So anyway, yeah, those are my thoughts on those things. If you're playing Advance Wars or Horizon or whatever you're playing, let me know. I want to hear your thoughts as always. I do enjoy interacting with you guys and talking with you guys on Patreon and whatever. And I am planning some new videos. I'm considering maybe my next video will be about Rayman, but I'm still kind of honing in on that right now. I'm considering doing a Patreon exclusive video, which will talk about cancelled Wii U games. So that is something which I'm probably going to be doing next. Maybe before the end of the month, but we'll see. But yeah, on that note though, it's time to end. Shout out to my top level backers on Patreon. Shout out to Brian Guzman, Don Koopman, Eric Schusler, Jack Craig, Chrissy Chu, Merovigium, Shonik, Centinator of Team Harry, Cezla Cube, Shane Gale, and Stuart Radley. Thank you, everyone, for sticking around and supporting my work. And, you know, I am getting, like, fewer and fewer patrons nowadays, so I'm probably going to have to, I think, I don't know, do something different with Patreon or stop it altogether. But, you know, for the few people who are still around and listen to what I say and everything, like, I really appreciate it. So, yeah, thank you for your support. And, yeah, I'll be back soon in the near future with more videos and more podcasts. So, yeah, catch you then, guys. Bye-bye.